What up, folks? It's O'Shea Davis with the Working Wonder Podcast Show. And today is the second episode of Vernon E. Jordan, Part 2. I hope you enjoyed Part 1 of Vernon E. Jordan. Now we'll be discussing Part 2 about his time in Howard, his time with the NAACP, and other experiences in his life.
It is too often forgotten that the 1963 March on Washington was for more than just abstract rights.
At the time, he stated that he was very underwhelmed by the school from his initial impression, that many students seemed way more interested in partying than the actual prestige of the college, which he stated he did not oppose partying, but he also drew an unfair comparison to DuPont, which was a smaller school in a smaller town with much less activity to engage in. He later realized that his student counterparts were very much serious about school because of the professors and the reputation of the school. Howard has a graduate school in medical, dentistry, and law. Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court judge, spoke at his law school assembly, where he spoke about Charlie Houston, who was the dean of the law school in the 1930s, and helped perfect the strategy of using the 14th Amendment to bring about the piece-by-piece demolition of the South school system. Howard professors did research and helped prepare briefs for many of the important cases of the early part of civil rights era. The NAACP, Legal Defense, and Educational Fund, under direction of Marshall, did dry runs of Supreme Court arguments at Howard. This is me quoting Vernon. I went to every one that I could, sitting in a rapt attention with my classmates as the lawyers prepared to argue cases that would determine the course of our lives, lives of our children, for years to come. And all the great civil rights lawyers were right before us. Robert Carter, Thurgood Marshall, Robert Ming, William T. Coleman Jr., Frank Reeves, Louis Redman, Constant Baker, Motley, and Jake Greenberg. These were very influential lawyers of the time. And to see greatness with his own eyes and to be able to sit and mock versions of Supreme Court cases really made Vernon believe that he was in the right place, that this is exactly what he needed to be. Because at the time, Howard was the only school in America. Howard was the only university in the United States with a civil rights attorney course. He took a constitutional law class, and his professor was James Nabert. He was one of the best teachers I ever had, Vernon stated. Nabert was a Morehouse man and a graduate of Northwestern Law School, a superb teacher and a superb lawyer. He had argued Bowling versus Sharp, one of the four cases that became known under the head Brown versus Board of Education. He would later become the president of the university. When he died in 1997, it was Vernon's honor to give the eulogy at his funeral. Vernon goes on to say, even when we weren't dealing with civil rights, my other professors were very conscious of the fact that we were being trained to make a difference in American life. Not that everyone was going to go off to become a civil rights attorney. Most of us would not, of course. Just the fact that we were becoming professionals was a strike against the prevailing rules about blacks' limited place in American society. The movement was never an abstraction at Howard. It was a living, breathing part of our existence. On Sundays, he would attend the Rankin Chapel, where he would listen to messages of gospel along with the message of social justice. Preachers including Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Howard Thurman, Daniel Hill, Ralph David Abernathy, Samuel D. Proctor, Vernon Johns, and many more. One of Vernon's personal core philosophies was from a message he heard from Dr. Evans Crawford in 1957, in which Dr. Crawford spoke on how every individual should create his or her own tensions in life. I quote, other words, we should not let others create tensions for us. Giving over the powers allows others to set the agenda for what it is, after all, your own life. You will always be dancing to another person's tune, called for reasons that often are very little or nothing to do with you and your needs, and everything to do with problems, issues, and concerns that they may have in their own life. Vernon was clearly more happier, and it was much easier socially in Howard because he was much more accepted, where he could have friends and date more openly than he could in DuPont. One of Vernon's close friends at Howard was a man named Joseph E. Lockridge, who later was one of the first black individuals elected to Texas legislature in 1967. He died tragically the next year, 1968, in a plane crash. Vernon goes on in his chapter discussing his experiences in the fraternity life and befriending a girl named Shirley. I won't go into great detail of this portion of the book. In 1958, Vernon's second year in law school, he received a letter from his mother that after 28 years of marriage, his mother and father was getting a divorce. His father was moved out for a few months now, and they didn't want to break the news to Vernon. This clearly made him very sad, in which he couldn't hold back his tears. Later, Vernon married Shirley, who worked in Atlanta while he was still in law school at Howard. His best man was Joseph E. Lockridge, who was obviously still alive at this time. In his last few months of law school, Vernon's wife gave birth to his daughter, Vicky. Upon graduation, Vernon went back home to Atlanta, where he started his law career, working for Donald Hollowell, who was one of the co-operating attorneys with the NAACP, serving as a local counsel in the Legal Defense Fund and pursued a case in their area. Donald Hollowell was his mentor and teacher. At the time, there were no better mentor for Vernon than Mr. Hollowell. Vernon called him one of the most gifted trial attorneys in Georgia during the 1950s and 1960s. During the year of 1952, there were fewer than 15 black lawyers in the whole state, which made the job extremely difficult for the time of very heightened racial discrimination and segregation issues. Mr. Hollowell was primarily worked in real estate and paid Vernon $35 a week as a law clerk, which was not enough to make ends meet. So Vernon had to supplement his family income. At the time, his wife Shirley made more than him, working for Fulton County Welfare Department. So he worked as a barber and a bartender at night. And even assists his mother's catering business. I won't go into deep details of some of the horrendous cases, but since interracial relations was not accepted, it was not uncommon that many black males who had relations with white women would unjustly be punished to death penalty solely on the premise of presumed rape, mainly from the pressures of the family's social acceptance. All because the Justice Department and the world at the time did not want to see a black man and white woman together. They definitely did not want them to have children together. This was a very common occurrence all throughout the world. It wasn't uncommon for black males to be accused for murder based off mistaken identity or very little to no proof at all. Perfect example of this is Central Park 5 in 1989. It can't be ignored that punishment that was given to black males were often of little to no just cause. Ironically, there were states where black individuals could not even join the efforts of the NAACP or any progressive civil rights group for that matter, or they would be targeted by white supremacists. Even at times, they would be prosecuted by any means of threats by the law. It's important for me to draw the picture so those who are listening can truly understand that Mr. Hollowell and Vernon E. Jordan stood for, which is directly in line with Martin Luther King Jr. and many other significant civil rights leaders. Needless to say, race and sex or the intersection of such was treacherous territory during this time. One case, a young male was arrested for lewd statements speaking on the phone with his girlfriend because she asked about his penis size, and he said he would show her. The father was listening in on the phone call and got him arrested for the statement. Fortunately, the boy was released, but the judges ordered that the boy and his mother would have to leave town. This was because Hollowell and Vernon argued the case for this young boy's behalf. If he was sentenced to jail, he would have been in prison anywhere between 10 to 20 years for making a sexual statement to his girlfriend. Another case in Georgia, which two black military males in uniform were driving their nice car through what was known as Klan territory. Having a nice car and being black attracted the KKK. Not sure if the men driving was aware that they were in this area. It honestly doesn't matter. In no form were they breaking the law or doing anything wrong. They were eventually pulled out of their car, attacked, and killed. The Hollowell team won the case that was on the front paper of the Georgia newspaper and other national newspapers. It was not uncommon that cases such as these, the killers were often let go because the judge was either intimidated by the KKK or was a Klansman himself. Shortly after this victory, the state of Georgia passed a law that any university or college who accepted black students would lose all their state funding. Why? Because any means of advancement for people of color was not acceptable to the Georgia state government. It was a strategy that helped keep people oppressed, and it worked. But to the Hollowell team, the fight for racial injustice was just beginning. There were several monumental victories that helped shape the legal culture of discrimination in the state of Georgia because of these attorneys. With many more on their team, they contributed to this change. Names such as Horace T. Ward and Constance Baker Motley. Working for Hollowell, Vernon was then offered a job by Ruby Hurley, the head of the Southeast Regional Office of NAACP, as a field director. During this time, he worked for Mr. Hollowell for a year, and he got paid $5,700 a year, which for 1961, which is about $41,000 in today's time. That's what Ruby was going to pay him for working for the NAACP. Still was not much money for a lawyer today, but it was way better than the $35 a week, which after his raise with Mr. Hollowell was $50 a week. As the Georgia field director, he was the organizer, the advocate, and the program person in the state. His responsibilities were organizing new NAACP branches and increasing the membership of existing branches. He was the youngest of the field directors working for Miss Hurley. A contributing factor was that he flunked his Georgia exam. Shortly afterwards, during his University of Georgia case, he had a conversation with Eugene Cook, who was the attorney general, and he said that he was not going to pass Vernon because he needed to teach him a lesson for trying to progress the state of Georgia. He knew this was a suspicious statement, but he took the bar exam anyways, and he failed him. Ruby Hurley set up one of the regional chapters of the NAACP in Alabama and was forced to move to Atlanta because of the governor. Vernon described Ruby Hurley as tall, attractive, poised, elegant, and well-dressed. Being a woman, she was not accepted into a top-ranked position. Sexism hobbled the society at large during these days, and even an organization based on social movement. The basic job of an NAACP field director was to build the membership of local chapters, help them organize events, respond whenever there are allegations of discrimination, and, in the area of protest and demonstrations, to decide when and if those activities were warranted. The NAACP focused primarily on law, taking actions through courts and promoting voter education and registration with the aim of election officials who would then write and support legislation beneficial to Black advancement. This was no easy task during this era. This was no easy task during the era of Jim Crow laws in the South. NAACP's favorite process-oriented action geared toward evolution rather than revolution. Other civil rights groups exist as well, such as the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Congress of Racial Equality, and Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and many others. As you may know, Blacks could not enter the front door of many establishments and often couldn't use the same bathroom as white people. Often, establishments would choose not to even have restrooms for Blacks or even serve them food, denying them the basic human right of natural services. Blacks and colored-only bathrooms were often not clean and in terrible conditions. Toilets may not even work. They were just filthy. Martin Luther King Jr., at the time, was the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and Roy Wilkins of the NAACP was in courts along with Thurgood Marshall. Whitney Young of the National Urban League was in the boardrooms explaining it all to the country's business leaders. Younger activists often had less patience than leaders of older organizations, which led to tensions within the overall movement. Mr. Hollowell was one of MLK's lawyers after King broke an injunction of an organized march which sparked the Albany movement for civil rights. The NAACP was like an insurance company to the civil rights movements and other organizations, paying the dues to organizations, covering them for such contingencies as getting arrested for protests and sit-ins, which clearly made them a target for politicians who wanted to punish those who challenged segregation laws and discriminatory policies and practices. Vernon decided in 1963 to leave the NAACP to pursue other organization ventures. Mrs. Hurley was not happy about his decision and didn't speak to him for months afterwards. Another influential figure in the NAACP was Megger Evers, who was also upset with Vernon's decision but accepted the explanation.
Megger Evers was a dear friend of mine, and we were colleagues. Megger was the field secretary for the NAACP in Mississippi. I was the field secretary for the NAACP in Georgia. Medgar was a little older, much more experienced. He mentored me. And I spent a lot of time with him in Mississippi. He spent a lot of time with me in Georgia. And when I made the move to go to the Southern Regional Council, I called Medgar and said to him that I was going to leave. And Medgar said, "Vernon, you have to do that. I cannot leave." I do believe that Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King Jr. are two men in the movement who really knew and understood what their ultimate destiny was going
to
be.
Vernon entered off to his new job working for the Southern Regional Council. The very next month, Medgar Evers was killed by an assassin's bullet in front of his house while his children was inside. The murdering of this influential figure obviously did not stop there. In the 1960s, the murder of the Kennedys, the murder of Dr. King, and the four girls in a Birmingham church bombing, all being martyrs for the cause. Medgar Evers' murder affected Vernon deeply. He was a close friend and an associate. During Medgar's funeral, there was a march in his honor. This is the first time that Vernon truly experienced the hatefulness of the Southern police force of the era. The Southern Regional Council, or the SRC, was the perfect learning experience for Vernon. This is where he took his new job, and by his side was Leslie Dunbar, his friend and an advisor. During this time, Vernon published his first article for The Nation's magazine in 1964. While at SRC, he also passed his bar exam in Arkansas because he still believed he was a target based on previous statements made by the Attorney General of Georgia. In the summer of 1964, Wiley Brandon became the executive director of Welfare National Civil Rights Organizations. Though he remained director of Voters Education Program, Vernon became the acting director, focusing on how to hold states accountable for discriminatory practices that prevent blacks from voting in white primaries.
The only time that I had been in a corporate boardroom was with a white jacket on, serving my mother's food. And then when I got to the college fund, I started going to corporate boardrooms. And what I found out, that the people I was talking to were no smarter or more articulate than I was. And I had a story to tell, and I told it. They listened, and the college fund my first year raised more money than had ever been raised before.
Legally, blacks were allowed to vote at this time, but states would create roadblocks with poll taxes, grandfather clauses, literacy tests, and even have things such as how many bubbles were in a bar of soap. Even if they passed all this, they would still, and would often, deny them the ability to vote. This was all up to the voter's booth discretion. Added to all this was a quasi-legal tactics. Generally, the pattern of intimidation by state registrars, local police, act of violence, and economic coercion by private citizens within the white community against black citizens. Voting was critical during the time, and it was very critical during the time of the Republican presidential candidate that year of 1964, which was Senator Barry Goldwater. He took a strong stand against civil rights, while most Democrats under President Lyndon B. Johnson were in favor. The attitude that Republicans are against civil rights hasn't changed much because of the shift in voters' rights since 1964. Voter education program became the primary vehicle for channeling money to organizations that supported voters' rights. Later, JFK focused his efforts on calling young people to service during his presidency, urging the government to fight against poverty and assist with civil rights. This made him a highly targeted president. Vernon became an attorney consultant for the Office of Economic Opportunity and was to review grants for community action programs. The political game was the centerpiece of the battle for civil rights and an advancement. Vernon states, politics is about working things out with people who do not necessarily agree with you. Economic development and voters' rights participating in democracy are central to black advancement. Voting is the most essential form of direct action. By denying black votes, it's limiting the influence that black people can have in their fundamental right, which retains the power of those who did not want to see advancement of people of color. What made VEP voting education program so influential was the fact that major philanthropists and other foundations such as the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Field Foundation, and the Stern Family Foundation relied on VEP to distribute money where it could do the most good, which was to send money to organizations such as the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of MLK, the Congress of Racial Equality, the NAACP, and the Student of Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The learning process was tough for Vernon, realizing what projects work and didn't, and that a good heart and good intentions is not enough. Strategy was vital to the successful execution of his plans that they had in place. Later, the goal was to get more black elected officials to the primaries and to get more voices in the government to advocate and keep accountability for the disenfranchised communities that were openly getting discriminated against. In 1965, Vernon's wife, Shirley, was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, which has no cure. Shirley was only 28 years old at the time. Shortly after the murder of MLK, 1968, Vernon got a call inviting him to a fellow at the Institute of Politics at the JFK School of Government at Harvard, which he became the first black fellow ever. This was a temporary 6-month position, which he enjoyed. At the same time, 1968 was one of the most politically charged years of the century. Vernon taught seminars to black Americans and about the Southern political process. At age 33, he was offered the job to be the president of Dillard University. He turned down the position, not feeling equipped for it, and did not feel like it was supposed to be in his life at the time. In 1970, Vernon decided to run for Congress for the 5th District congressional seat, which he lost. He later accepted the job as a college fund executive director at Dillard University. Shortly afterwards, he left that position for a job for the Negro College Fund in New York at a rate of $42,000, so $42,000, which was $20,000 more than his job at the Dillard University. $42,000 in 1970 is equivalent to $323,000 today, which was a fantastic pay rate even for living in New York. His first year as director of the Negro College Fund, he raised $10 million in 1971, which is way more than the organization has ever had in its history. In March 9, 1971, Whitney Young, the director of the National Urban League, who played an influential role in Vernon's development while in New York, and a close friend from Atlanta, drowned while in Nigeria, which was another devastating loss to the civil rights movement and to Vernon personally. Whitney's body was flown back to the U.S. by Chappie James, which was the first black general in the Air Force. Vernon later became the executive director and then the president of the National Urban League. Vernon even met with presidents such as Lyndon B. Johnson, Jimmy Carter, and Nixon on several matters that I won't go too much in detail about. You can read these details in his book. He was even an advisor to President Clinton as well. So let's fast forward to the year 1985, December 27th. Vernon's wife, Shirley, passed away when she went into cardiac arrest because of her diminishing condition of MS. Vernon stated, "Our life together, our marriage was cut short. Marriage is a mystery. Occasionally, the person who is in it, but at all times to those outside of the partnership. The shared struggles, triumphs, hopes, and tragedies, and vulnerabilities create a unique challenge of the two. The death of a spouse, an involuntary rupture, is a trauma that every couple determined to go the distance will eventually experience." Shirley was 48 years old. Vernon's sense of loss was immense, too large to take in or to adequately describe. In November 1986, he were married to Ann Dipple Cook. At the time, she was a professor at the University of Chicago and a director of social services. In 1987, his father passed away. In 1992, his mother passed away. Throughout the book, Vernon speaks on leadership, what he learned and accomplished in his different positions, the relationships he fostered, the major takeaway and complications of racial issues that occur all throughout his life that are very prevalent even today. This was a marvelous autobiography of Vernon E. Jordan, who passed away in 2021. I hope you were inspired by his story. I hope you learned about a very influential figure in American history. Thank you for listening and tune in to the next episode. This is O'Shea Davis with the Work and Wonder podcast show. I appreciate all of you who click listen. Subscribe, like, comment, and share. Thank you.